From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The first voice of Laura Lippman's latest novel comes from beyond the grave, apparently the victim of murder. She speaks directly and disdainfully to the main character, Maddie Schwartz, as Maddie transforms herself from conventional housewife to aspiring reporter. We hear from other characters she meets: Baltimore's first female African-American police officer, a bartender, a medium, journalists, an old boyfriend. They all tell bits of their own stories, but Lippman notes they also tell us something significant about the ambitious Maddie.
She was moving through a city that was teeming with stories. And if Maddie had just paused here or there to ask a question or to even wonder about a person that she had an encounter with, she would have learned a whole new story.
Lippman's latest mystery, Lady in the Lake, on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Hope you're enjoying a restful Labor Day. This morning, we're listening again to our conversation with mystery writer Laura Lippman about her 24th book, this one set in Baltimore, 1966. As she shapes it, you can already feel humming beneath the interactions of blacks and whites the tension that would erupt into riots 2 years later. The expectations of deference are getting shaky. Roles that seemed fixed for decades now seem fluid. What kind of job can a woman in her 30s aspire to? What does it take, beyond money and affection, to keep a marriage going? Why are news judgments that used to apply only to whites starting to shape coverage of African Americans? Into this ebb and flow, Lippman inserts her latest mystery. A beautiful young black woman ends up dead, invisible under the waters of the fountain in Druid Hill Park. So the novel is titled Lady in the Lake. It pulls readers so deeply into the living characters that solving the murder becomes almost an afterthought. When I spoke with Lippman in July, I asked her to tell us about the first character we meet, the lovely young woman who's gone missing, Cleo Sherwood.
Cleo Sherwood is beautiful. She's young, she's headstrong, and she's a ghost. And it was not my plan to write a novel with a ghost in it, but as I began working on this novel, I realized that it had to have Cleo's voice in it. And how could that be when, at the beginning of the novel, Cleo Sherwood no longer exists? So I thought, fine, here comes a ghost.
And so she speaks to us at least 10 times in the course of this book. She addresses us directly.
She addresses the reader directly, and she also addresses a woman named Madeline Schwartz directly, a woman that has decided to make it her goal, her business, her aim to find out how Cleo Sherwood came to die, how she came to be in that fountain. And Cleo is on to Maddie from the first moment she sees her, and will later in the book say to Maddie, who could never hear her across this void, "You weren't interested in my life. You were interested in my death. They're not the same thing."
I am so taken with Cleo's voice. I want listeners to hear it. Would you read the end of Cleo's first chapter on page 7?
"God knows, my death has changed me. Alive, I was Cleo Sherwood. Dead, I became the Lady in the Lake, a nasty, broken thing, dragged from the fountain after steeping there for months, through the cold winter, then that fitful, bratty spring, almost into summer proper. Face gone, much of my flesh gone. And no one cared until you came along, gave me that stupid nickname, began rattling doorknobs and pestering people, going places you weren't supposed to go. No one outside my family was supposed to care. I was a careless girl who went out on a date with the wrong person and was never seen again. You came in at the end of my story and turned it into your beginning. Why'd you have to go and do that, Madeline Schwartz? Why couldn't you stay in your beautiful house and your good enough marriage and let me be at the bottom of the fountain? I was safe there. everybody was safer when I was there.
So that's the first chapter in the book. It totally hooks us, of course. You haven't really told me much about Cleo Sherwood in this conversation.
Cleo is a young woman in her 20s. She grew up in Baltimore. She's beautiful. She's African American. We know that. I'm very careful in this book not to describe her skin color, other than to say that she's African American, because I feel that that is a bad habit that some writers have fallen into. I began to notice that there was a terrible habit among white writers to describe people of color, often in food terms. I suddenly noticed there were a lot of latte-colored and mocha-colored and cappuccino skin. And I thought, you know, white characters more or less just show up as white unless there's something really odd or notable about their pigment.
If they have a rash, for example.
Right. But I felt that there was something about that habit, as well-intended as it was, that again establishes whiteness as a default, as in white is white is white is white is white, and it doesn't need to be defined. And whereas historically, skin shade has affected African Americans, I don't think it's a white writer story to tell. So I made a rule for myself that I wanted people to know that Cleo Sherwood was very beautiful. She has a gorgeous nose. She's called Cleo because she was nicknamed Cleopatra at a very young age because of her resemblance to the Egyptian queen. And she's in her 20s. She's had two children by two different men. And she's very determined to find a man who's not going to leave her with a third child living in her parents' too crowded apartment up near Druid Hill Park. And to do that, she has accepted that she has to take finding that man as seriously as another woman might take finding a vocation. This will be her ticket out. This will be the way she cares for those who love her. But she also likes a good time. She works as a cocktail waitress in a second-rate joint on Pennsylvania Avenue, where she wears a ridiculous costume. She flirts with the men who come in. But there's one man in particular that she cares about, that she has her eye on, and that is the root of her problems.
And what is the answer to the question that, in the passage you read, she poses to Maddie Schwartz? Why did Maddie have to go and do what she does? What motivates Maddie?
Maddie is a 37-year-old Northwest Jewish housewife in Baltimore, who thinks herself happy and content until a chance encounter with someone she knew in high school reminds her of the lofty ambitions that she had, that she thought she was going to be someone who mattered. She thought she was going to do things in this world. So without even knowing what those things are, she leaves her soon-to-be empty nest, her good-enough husband, as I think Cleo called him, her son, who is only in high school, and she bolts. And then she herself is confused. How will I matter? What will I do? And she comes to the case of Cleo Sherwood almost by serendipity. Her involvement as a civilian in the death of another person in Baltimore, a small child, leads her to focus on getting a job at the newspaper. She gets a job as a clerk, and it's in answering a letter to the helpline column that she ends up being the person who sets in motion the events that uncover the body of Cleo Sherwood, whose disappearance has not even been noted by the daily newspapers at this point, and whose death is given rather cursory treatment. So Maddie sees an opening. If she can find a fascinating story in the death of Cleo Sherwood, maybe she can write her way into a reporter's job at the newspaper.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Laura Lippman about her novel Lady in the Lake, set in Baltimore in the 1960s.
Why was no one paying attention to Cleo Sherwood's disappearance? Police, press, no one.
Would anyone pay attention today? It hasn't changed that much. Women of color disappear. They seldom become national stories, especially in the event of a disappearance of someone who appears to be somewhat flighty. Why would people care? Why would people get involved? I wish things had changed more. I wish I could tell you, oh, today if this happened, it would be a huge story. I think it would be a bigger story today, especially because it's such an interesting mystery. And the real life case that inspired this that happened in 1969, the death of Shirley Parker, by the time her body was found, they weren't even able to determine a cause of death. And absent a cause of death, they could not rule it an official homicide. So it lingers, this question mark.
That case.
That
still
case,
open case.
Still open. Still not determined. And based on what I know, which is not a lot about forensic science, there's not a lot of probability that any advances will be made. There's just nothing there. You know, there. It's not for the lack of the scientific knowledge of the mid-60s. It was just that there wasn't anything about the body. I had one friend, Jonathan Hayes. He's a medical examiner and a novelist. He looked at some of the information I had about it and said, it struck him as odd that they couldn't come up with a cause of death, but he didn't see how, based on what was said at the time, that any new information would ever be forthcoming, I mean, other than a confession.
Cleo Sherwood is not the only character who speaks to us in Lady in the Lake. As the story unfolds, almost every time we meet someone, the next chapter belongs to them. They each give us their perspective or a bit of their story. What are you doing with that technique?
I think my greatest fear is that I'm going to be like Maddie Schwartz, and I'm going to be so focused on what I want that I'll become curious about anything that isn't part of what I want, that doesn't suit or help my immediate agenda. And so almost out of that fear, I wanted to write about someone who was so intent on one story that she was moving through a city that was teeming with stories. And if Maddie had just paused here or there to ask a question or to even wonder about a person that she had an encounter with, she would have learned a whole new story.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. We're talking to Laura Lippman about her latest mystery, Lady in the Lake. I've been saving up my questions about all the newspaper angles of this novel. We'll pick those up when we're back. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. On this last gasp of summer holiday, we're listening back to our conversation with Baltimore writer Laura Lippman about her 24th novel. Its title, Lady in the Lake, refers to a lovely African-American woman who winds up dead in the fountain of Druid Hill Park in 1966. This is no police procedural leading us to the killer. It's much more of a psychological portrait of women whom society classifies very differently. It's also a story about newspapers and the people who write them. But Lippman says she didn't know that when she started writing the novel in early 2017. So when did she realize where the story was heading?
My original hazy intent in the fall of 2016 was, well, I'm not going to try to write a novel set in contemporary times. It seemed quite impossible to me in the last weeks of 2016. Everyone I knew was just on social media all the time and then running back and forth between the TV and the social media. I mean, this isn't partisan. It was just everybody I knew seemed to be kind of obsessed with the minute-by-minute soap opera we're in. And so I thought, I need to write about the past. And I'd always had this tiny little nugget of a fact stuck in my head about the parents of Tess Monahan.
Tess Monahan is a dozen Tess Monahan
right.
novels. She's a journalist turned private detective.
And that's where I started. And I had known for a long time that Tess Monahan's parents met while working on one of the Democratic primary campaigns of 1966. And I also knew that Tess had this mysterious, not quite relative known as Spike. And it was mentioned in the books that he committed a felony that kept him from having a bar license, but it was never explained what happened. I didn't know what happened. I was like, what did Spike do? It has something to do with 66 and maybe Tess's parents. And I had this vision of a novel in my head that was about the election, which of course is an election with a lot of parallels to 2016, with a political outsider, political insider. But in Maryland, the outsider was a Democrat, and Democrats held their nose and voted for Spiro Agnew, and he won. I mentioned it to my editor, and she said, and I, to this day, I can't tell you if her question was rhetorical, if it was meant to give me guidance, but she said, does it have to be about Tess's parents? And I thought, no, it doesn't have to be, but that's what I'm interested in right now. And then somehow the character of Maddie showed up. And it was like, okay, this is the person I want to write about. And now I need to sort of just fire her off into 1966, like, you know, like I'm firing a slingshot. And what would happen to her? What would she do? You know, I think I knew as little about Maddie's future as she did. Like, she wants to matter. How will she matter? I knew a lot of Maddie's secrets. I didn't know where she was headed. And then, of course, all of a sudden it's obvious that she's going to focus on becoming a reporter at the newspaper, that she's going to see that that's her way in. I really did go to the Pratt, I always do, and did a lot of research. And I was struck by the jobs that were advertised for women in 1966. And oh, and by the way, the classified ads in the mid-60s specified whether jobs are for men or women. I'd forgotten that lovely little detail from when I was a kid. So all of a sudden it became a newspaper novel, sort of in spite of me. I think newspaper novels are very dangerous for former newspaper writers to write.
For sure.
I think you can go down this rabbit hole of things that are of no interest to anyone else. And I was determined to have just enough of the essence of it. I corresponded with one of my father's former colleagues.
We should back up and say you yourself, of course, spent 20 years as a reporter for The Sun and other newspapers. But your father was an editorial writer and columnist. Your father, Theo Ted Lippman, for The Sun for
30 years.
A long time.
1965 through 1995. So he was been Maddie's contemporary.
And he died in 2014. So
yes.
This is just, you haven't written that many novels since his death.
No.
Was that at work in your sense of writing about that era of journalism? Because you're essentially, as you said, writing about his era. Or the beginning of his era.
It was very much at work. An unexpected thing about my father's death is that I'm often writing about him even when I don't think I'm writing about him. And Wild Lake, which was the novel I was working on when my father died, his influence was very much obvious because it's a father-daughter novel. But he showed up again, or somehow, again, he sort of haunted this book is what I would say. And I felt this real obligation to get a newsroom in the mid-1960s right. You know, it should be clear that the newspaper that I'm talking about in Lady in the Lake is very much influenced by the News American.
If, it's not the Baltimore Sun.
It's not even the Evening Sun.
So you needed to do some research, even though you grew up as a kid in a newspaper family.
Yeah, I think it's really dangerous to assume that just because you've lived through something, you remember it or you'll get it right. As a matter of fact, if you know something, sometimes you miss the most interesting aspects of it. You just take it for granted. Oh, everybody knows that about newspapers. Everybody knows that about Baltimore. So I always try to take a step back and sort of reimmerse myself in a subject as if I were new to it.
That's novelist Laura Lippman here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're speaking about her latest mystery, Lady in the Lake, inspired in part by two murders in Baltimore in the 1960s. I found myself, as I got to know Maddie Schwartz, thinking of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the, you know, I'm going to make it after all. And then I realized that was that hadn't happened yet. That was in the early 70s.
Right. She's a little bit ahead of the time. I know this sounds hard to believe, but I managed to write a book about a woman named Madeline, which is my mother's first name. And the woman is about the same age as my mother, a little bit older. And it never occurred to me until a reporter asked me if this book was inspired by my mother to even think about the connection. But then I thought about the connection, and my mother had her own much quieter, more proper revolution, which is it was in the late 1960s that she decided to go back to grad school in library science. And, you know, by that point, my sister and I were well into grade school. We could be latchkey kids. And that was what she pursued. And I think that, again, if, you know, we're talking about a book about a ghost, you know, my father who's gone kind of haunted the book, and my mother who's living informed the book.
The day after you finished the manuscript of Lady in the Lake came the terrible shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis on June 28, 2018. And one of the journalists killed, Rob Hyacin, was your friend. You've dedicated this novel to all five who were killed. You know, for all the shortcomings of society in 1966, people in schools and newsrooms were not targets of bullets.
No. No. And I would like to think that if there had been a mass shooting like this in 66, perhaps there would have been a response to it. In the 60s, we began to respond to the environmental challenges, and there was improvement. You know, lakes and rivers and the air quality improved because people said, oh, this is a problem, we need to change that. There are, of course, many, many things that I'll never forget about the day Rob and his colleagues were murdered. But I think the thing that chills my blood is that I had called my mother. I was on the road driving to where she lives in Delaware. And I called her to say we were on the other side of the bridge and should be there within 90 minutes. To which she said, oh, I thought you would have gotten slowed down in Annapolis. Oh, why is that, Mom? There was a shooting. Where? And in that split second before my mother told me where the shooting was, I was just so numb and so blasé and so accepting of the fact that there had been another shooting. I'll never be that again. But it shouldn't be that one has to have a first degree connection to a mass shooting to feel that way. I'm now, in hindsight, sad that I could have ever even been blasé in that split second, that I had gotten to the point where I accepted this, because, of course, that's what people who oppose stronger gun legislation want. They want us to be numb. They want us to feel that there's nothing to be done, that this is a political reality that cannot be tampered with. And I'll never feel that way again. I don't always know what to do or what I can do as an individual, but my friend and his colleagues were murdered. And no one should have to think about whether their workplace is safe, whether their school is safe. I go to a salon every 5 weeks to get my brows tinted, not to get too TMI there. And it's a very female setting, a salon.
Sure.
And I don't know where the back door is. And I think about this every time, which is, all it takes is for one employee here, one client here, to have an angry, estranged partner with a weapon, and we're all at risk. I think about this. And why? Who should think about this? It's like, okay, I'm here in my towel, lying on a bed with the nice music playing. What do I do if shots ring out? Where is the exit? What should we do? Should we fall to the floor and lock the door? Should we try to get out? And I don't think I think that way just because I'm a novelist with a vivid imagination. I think, unfortunately, we now live in an era where it's actually pretty smart to be looking for the exits.
It's a sober thought. Thanks for talking to us.
Always good to check in. It's just a pleasure to talk to someone who reads so thoughtfully and comes up with such great questions.
It's such a great book.
Laura Lippman's latest mystery is Lady in the Lake. A week from tonight, September 9th, Lippman will speak to the Women's Daily Post about the novel, followed by discussion, and then a panel of women describing the paths they've taken to becoming published authors. It starts at 6:30 p.m. at Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, 7 South Calvert Street in Baltimore. And the $35 ticket price includes a copy of the novel and a donation to the Enoch Pratt Free Library. The following Saturday, September 14th, as part of the Pratt's grand reopening celebration, Lippman will be in conversation with another newspaper writer turned novelist, Sujata Massey. That will be from 1 to 2 p.m. in Wheeler Auditorium, a week from Saturday. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to information about both events. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. I'm your host, Sheila Cast. Thanks for sharing your holiday morning with us. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.